This time on the Plutopia podcast, Doc Searles and Dave DeBronkart take aim at the American healthcare system. They discuss empowered patients, medical technology, electronic medical records, and much more.
To my persistent astonishment, doctors want to communicate, send data to each other by fax. An ancient analog technology. It's still the case.
I know. And there's so much foolishness, you know, that they will complain that email is not a secure way to send you your information. And yet they, because it could leak, well, there are constant horror stories.
As a digital thing, it can leak. An analog can't leak because it's actually not digital.
Well,
exactly.
Guess what? There are common horror stories of a doctor's fax machine dialing a wrong number and sending all your private information.
There's an analog hold for you.
Here we are with another Plutopia podcast. And we have two guests today, Dave DeBronkart, known on the internet as ePatient Dave. Dave is a blogger, a health policy advisor, and international keynote speaker. And Dave beat stage 4 kidney cancer back in 2007, and he is still going strong, and he is an empowered patient. We're also joined by Doc Searles, who is a journalist, a columnist, a widely read blogger, and was co-author of the Plutrain Manifesto, a book about, it was kind of about the impact of internet on marketing. It said that conventional marketing techniques are rendered obsolete by the online conversations that consumers have and companies need to join. And that, you know, that's proven to be true. The Plutrain Manifesto came out a few years ago. And Dave, just the other day, wrote a blog post called The Evolution of Who Knows What, a Plutrain Manifesto for Empowered Patients. And we're gathered here partly to discuss that particular post. Dave, how did the Plutrain Manifesto inspire that blog post?
Well, so you can guide me as to how deep we want to go into this, but
We got an hour. You can talk for an hour, and then we have to stop.
So the short version of it is that after my cancer, and an important thing is I was like desperately dead sick. My median survival at diagnosis was 24 weeks, according to the best available data. And yet 6 months later, my treatment had ended. And a couple of months after that, the doc said, dude, looks like you beat it. They didn't quite phrase it that way. But an important part, I mean, part of it was that I got a powerful, potent immunotherapy that usually didn't work. And sometimes it killed people. All right. And I, rather than just sitting back and crossing my fingers and hoping, I did something that turns out was really weird, which was I asked the doctors, so how do I prepare for the side effects? And here they are at Dana-Farber in Boston, best cancer place in the world for this disease. And they said, that's interesting. Nobody's ever asked us that. Now, at the time, I didn't know the vocabulary, but now I know that what I was doing was being an empowered, engaged patient. And for any of our listeners who aren't aware of what that really means, an empowered person is the polar opposite of a powerless person. A powerless person says, well, there's nothing I can do about it, right? Can you hear the lack of power? So there I was saying, you know, I'm dying here. What can I do to help myself? And I spoke up. And so having asked the doctors, and they actually said they don't have any advice. So then my doctor, Danny Sands, who you know very well, for those who don't know, Dr. Sands and John are co-founders of the e-patient movement back in the last century. He had steered me to an expert patient community. Stodgy, arrogant doctors will say, stay off the internet. Instead, Dr. Sands said, he showed me where to find the good stuff. And from them, and this is just so freaking radical even today, from the patients, I got 16 firsthand stories who've been through this treatment and survived it. And a few years later, when my evangelism had gotten rolling, the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, asked me to write my case up. And I wanted other doctors to be evangelized by this, not just by me. So I asked my oncologist, what would you want other doctors to know about my case? And he said, you were really sick, and I don't know if you could have tolerated enough medicine if you hadn't been so prepared. All right, now here we start getting into the crux of it, because what he was talking about, they said they had never seen a patient act like me, right, asking what can I do to help myself, and then getting information and accessing information that I would not have had available if it weren't for the internet. All right, starting to see the connection with Clue Train here. And instead of top-down, one-directional, medicine pushes information to us, it was two-way dialogue, right? Markets are conversations. Medicine is conversations today. And the thing that I absolutely loved was a couple of years after that, when I went in for a follow-up visit, the Dana-Farber people handed me something, a little booklet, and they said, we thought you might enjoy seeing this. They created a booklet of how to tolerate side effects, right? Arising directly out of that exchange that we had. So this is, so you can start to see why I said in that blog post, to me very much, this is, I used to work in marketing myself, the Clue Train manifesto for empowered patients. And it all comes down to who has access to information and who doesn't. And as you know, the illustration I put at the top of that blog post was Martin Luther back in the 1500s nailing his 95 theses to the door of the cathedral, basically telling the power structure, yo, we don't need you to read it to us anymore. We will read it and make our draw our own conclusions.
And this is a good time to ask Doc. Doc, you had your own experience as an e-patient, correct?
Oh, I've had many of them. Too many, actually. But I could go into those. But actually, we have a rule, because now that I'm in the final demographic, as I call it, 65 plus. And I'm more than a decade past that, that there's a rule among my cohort that you've got 5 minutes to talk health, and then we're going to talk about something else. It doesn't matter what you see this.
Because would kill all of my conversations.
It kill a lot of conversations, so I'll minimize that. An interesting thing about the Clue Train Manifesto, I wanted to mention that. First, Dave, we called it... we gave it 95 theses. That was marketing, because it worked for Luther. And if you read through them, you'll find that most of them are actually packing material, and they're really about eight. They're really worthwhile in there. Markets are Conversations is the first one, and David Weinberger's Hyperlinks Subvert Hierarchy is another critical one. There's one that came from Chris Locke, I think, that said, we don't want e-advertising, just forget it, stop. Something like that, which did not work. An interesting thing about it, though, is that the three of us, not all four, came in different ways from the marketing world. None of us wanted to be there. David Weinberger is has a PhD in philosophy, and is a really deep dude, a fantastic writer. Chris Locke is basically also just a writer of, or he was, he's gone now, sadly, but just a incredibly, I mean, the voice of Clue Train is really the voice of Chris, whose nickname was Rage Boy, because he had rage, and Esther Dyson gave him that name in a way. And but it was actually an anti-marketing book, of anything. It was, we're basically said, you're doing it wrong. And the markets mattered more than marketing, and markets needed to be able to talk to themselves. And I think Clue Train is one of those rare books where it was made a bestseller by the wrong people for the wrong reasons. It was really spoken to people. But it is really Web 1.0. We kept, I mean, it's still there. The original HTML is still there. You know, you could sign it if you go down there on the left there for people who are watching. I think it's Buzz or Fuzz. You could actually sign the Clue Train Manifesto. And we stopped it when the page got too long. It only had like 1,000 lines in it because everybody was on dial-up at that time. But one of those there is actually he calls himself Juke. It was a famous producer, movie producer. So many. Anyway, it was fun. It was a fun thing. But the weird thing is that the older I get, the earlier it seems. Everything that we want to have happen will happen eventually. I think the future is unevenly distributed. Anyway, I don't know if this helps or not, but one of the things, Dave, especially I want to go to, by the way, my real name is David. There's so many Davids that I got the nickname. I've lived in four places in the last few years. Santa Barbara, where I am now, which is a permanent home, but Boston, when I got the fellowship at the Berkman Center at Harvard, which is where David Weinberger still is. I'm not, but my project is still there, but I'm not. And then New York, when something happened at NYU, and now in Bloomington, Indiana, with Indiana University. So my wife and I are visiting scholars there. And we're there because they like our ideas, which is great. You know, so great, we'll go there, we'll move there. Also, you could buy a house there for about 1/10. You could buy it in California or New York. So that's what we've done. And anyway, getting doctors to communicate with each other is on the verge of impossible. I do not have access to records of myself except through my chart in some of those places, and my chart is very incomplete. You can integrate them now. It's owned by Epic, and Epic is helpful if you don't mind having a single vendor running everything inside the, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, Dave, healthcare in the US is a B2B insurance business that is traveling as a free market business, for where we are. I mean, everybody on the political right wants to say, oh, it ought to be, the free market ought to be able to run all of healthcare and everybody's on their own. But in fact, it's never been the case. And it's an insurance business. And sometimes we get hit with what insurance can't cover. But these entities don't communicate with each other at all, don't want to. And I actually gave up on getting a heart monitor in California to use for my cardiologist in Indiana, simply because out here, I mean, I needed to get one for, you know, and the doctors on both sides said, yeah, okay, we'll help you out. But then the system in California said, well, officially you've switched doctors, so you have to meet with that doctor before he can obey an order from some other place. And that can happen in August, when, by the way, I'm going to be in Indiana anyway, so to hell with it. But it's all to monitor atrial fibrillation, which happens to me every once in a while. I'm sure I'll survive. You know, that's a relatively minor thing that could be dealt with something called ablation, which I'll probably get out there, but they want to have the monitor for a while first. But I literally gave up on trying to make these two systems cooperate with each other. And I also gave up on New York and Boston. I've totally forgotten about at this point. That's been a few years, and I'm not sure the records are relevant. But when I was there, thank you, Harvard, their system, which I was in at the time, was able to get, I gave them the names of 19 prior healthcare providers, and they sent in stuff. Everything they sent was, I'm not kidding, scans of copies of faxes of scans of copies that were almost entirely unreadable, totally disorganized, and not useful in any way whatsoever. So part of this is the record keeping side of this and the way it's all organized. And ideally, the patient should be the point of integration for their own data and for everything about them, and be able to carry this in a useful way from one provider to another, and one special to you to another. And that's very, very possible.
Well, I do think this is changing a bit. just from my own experience, the physicians I've been working with, and I've had, you know, various things happen recently where I had medical interventions, and they all seem to be sharing data with each other. And
Are they in the same system? Or are they?
I'm not clear about there. There is some way that they are accessing those records. A lot of the places we use MyChart. There's also something called MyHealthOne, which is the hospital system that I've been to a couple of times uses MyHealthOne, and then the clinic I go to uses MyChart, and there was an association of. I also have atrial fibrillation, so I have electrophysiologists I deal with.
Right. I've got those carriers kicking around too. Yeah.
And you know, just the other day, like recently, I have a primary care physician who is a Cuban woman who keeps tabs on all of this stuff. And she was just showing me the other day, she was like, reading me notes from an office visit I'd had with another physician within her system, of course, which made it easier for her to access. But she seems to be very aware of everything that's going on. And I recently went in, we had a kind of dance about my my AFib and my the question of whether I have congestive heart disease. Mm-hmm. I have a slight amount of calcium, but it's not built up too much. And at some point, someone had made a note that I had congestive heart disease. And we were having trouble. I don't think we ever figured out what the source of that was, exactly how that got entered into the record. But as it turns out, I don't have a serious problem with my heart. And I worked that out through a conversation with her, and she sent me to the cardiologist, and he looked at everything, and they were all kind of in sync, and it was pretty easily resolved. And I think in the like in the parts of the system where that you're talking about, where it still is dysfunctional and not working very well, and the connections aren't being made, I think that it wouldn't have been as easy to resolve that and to work that out. And pretty much I've been having really good healthcare experiences here in Austin, Texas, because everybody seems to be in sync with each other. They seem to be connected and they seem to be on top of everything. And I have a really good primary care physician.
Well, I have to kick in though about Austin medical care. I've had my wife actually has had a different experience, because she's had several really extreme health care problems. She had breast cancer for the second time, which ended up in a double mastectomy. And then she had an accident where she broke her ankle, and it ended up with it being amputated. And the doctors for the amputation wanted her to go to a inpatient rehab hospital in the middle of COVID. This was in the midst of the worst of COVID. And I already knew the state of rehab hospitals in Texas, which are loosely regulated, actually almost not regulated at all. Many, many inpatients there died of COVID because of, you know, lax, you know, infection control and such things. So, you know, by having the benefit of being involved in some of these e-patient panels that we've done on Plutopia, I have to credit, you know, Dave, you know, what you've started helped me insist on us getting what we wanted. We wanted home health care, which is covered by Medicare, and we had previous experience with it that was good, and they had good infection control and had a really good outcome. But without that knowledge that I had a right to speak up and insist on care that was beneficial to my wife, you know, she may have died.
Well, that's really good. I certainly didn't start this. I mean, I very well remember the meeting in February 2008, where with Danny Sands, I met John and the other ePatient founders. I surely have been the loudest mouth evangelist spreading the word. So I want to get back to a couple of...
Dave, we should just mention, since you're saying you didn't start it, the person who started it was Tom Ferguson, and Tom is no longer with us, but he did. He's the one who brought all these people together, and he had worked with Whole Earth Catalog, for instance, as their medical guy. He was an advocate for self-care. He actually published a magazine called Medical Self-Care at one time, and he put together this ePatients white paper. And they were working on that when I got involved with this group of people who he just had several colleagues that he worked with, and they were all inspired by him. They were all dedicated to the idea that patients should be empowered and that patients should really be in the driver's seat for their health care. Sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to point that out.
That's entirely relevant, entirely relevant. So, Doc, I'm concerned, you say, so this heart monitor, are you familiar with the $200 version you can buy on Amazon called Cardia, a live
No,
core?
Not at all. I've worn
I'll put
the
it
Holter
in the
monitors.
Chat here, because you can have Cardia. One. Here, I'll just put it in the chat. You can literally have one tomorrow. And this exquisitely ties into the theme of the evolution of who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, this thing, I was involved in some of the early experiments with it. The doctors were predictably very, very skeptical that anything you could get off Amazon could be clinically useful. But I know some really skeptical docs now who say, yeah, this thing is real. There's one guy at my hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess, who occasionally does a stint in the ER, and what they will do when somebody comes in from an accident to reliably assess the guy is slap this thing on their fingers, because all you do is put two fingers on the electrodes, and it will tell them in 30 seconds the basics of what's going on with the heart, and he will take a snapshot of that and email it upstairs, because that's quicker than the data going through their EMR system.
Sure.
And a good friend, John, have you ever had Hugo Campos on?
We have not had him on.
So this guy has a much more serious problem. He has a major heart defect called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where that his heart can just basically at any point stop working and he'll die. So he has an implanted defibrillator, and get this, he wants to see the data stream coming out of this thing so he can tell in real time, what the hell was that? Was that VTAC? Was it AFib? Whatever. And Medtronic, the manufacturer, says, no, that data may be coming out of your heart, but it belongs to Medtronic. It belongs to your doctor, actually. So Hugo has wonderful stories of what he's done to compensate for that. That's a story for another day. But this is the huge shift that it was part of what I blogged about.
But this is really important
Hugo,
stuff.
Yeah. Yes. So these home medical devices now, some of which are homemade and some of which are like hackers, and some of which are just things like the Alive Core that I just told you about, they make it possible today for you and me to have more information about ourselves than our doctors do.
Well, here's an important thing. So it was my two cardiologists in New York. One was the electrophysiologist. One was the regular cardiologist, who refer to themselves as the plumber and the electrician. These are at Columbia Presbyterian. And the plumber said, you have to get an Apple Watch because it'll tell you you know, you can check for AFib. It'll keep track of your heart. So I'll show you this right now. This, see here, there it is. I put it in front of the camera. There's a little, if the, you'll see there's a, if you look closely, there's a blip where my heart rate is from 57, which it was mostly overnight, and my resting is in the 50s. Yeah. But there's a blip where it goes up to 124. That was an AFib moment. Okay. That was an AFib moment that happened. And I'm just wondering about this particular monitor. Oh, and by the way, and that's what happened when I came in to see this guy. He said, you know, it'll cost the hospital $200 for me to give you to pull an EKG. He said, or I can look at your watch. So let me look at your watch or your app. And that's helpful. I could tell, oh, you look like you did last time. That's fine. But here's here's a question. So the heart monitor that they wanted me to, there's one called Holter that you wear for like 24 hours or 48 hours. But there's another one that you actually wear for like a month and then send it in. That's the one I wanted to get in Santa Barbara to have data for Bloomington, Indiana. Will this particular one, you said it works with two fingers. You put them on an electrode that's like a separate device that's not a watch that you wear or is not the phone. What is it
it's a funny thing. You know, you can, if you just look for AliveCor, AliveCor on Amazon for our viewers, you can see a picture of it. It's a little rectangular thing that has two silver squares on it.
I see.
And that's
okay.
It. You just put your fingers on it.
Yeah.
And it does magic EKG stuff. It is fully validated. It's recognized as good quality. So that on the left side there, phone,
yeah,
you just put your fingers on those two silver things.
And I've already clicked add to cart. I haven't bought it yet, but I added.
Well, with Bluetooth, it talks to the phone with Bluetooth on iPhone or Android.
Well, so, I can add one thing about the Apple Watch, Doc, which is I mean, when you have a blip like you talked about, that's no big deal. But if you go into AFib and it's like persistent and not going away, you have to deal with
then
it.
Then I go to the hospital and I've done that a few times.
And I recently had that happen. And, you know, your iPhone has a mechanism to alert you when you're in AFib. I was 2 hours into it before I got that alert, but I was very aware of it. I can feel it when I go into AFib.
Me too. It's disturbing.
And I took an EKG on the spot, and it showed that I was in AFib. It confirmed it. So I went directly to the ER.
And this is interesting. John, you were there for my first AFib. It was at the event we were at in Woods Hole. And I remember my pulse felt so weird. And I turned around, I gave my arm to you, and I said, feel this. My pulse doesn't feel right. And you said, it ain't right. And I left. I went to a hospital and they said to me, I never went back to the event, unfortunately. And they said to me, you're in AFib. And I hardly heard of it at that point. That was like 10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah. I had my first AFib in 2010, which I think is just a few years before that happened with you.
Yeah. So you already have your experience with it. Yeah.
Can I give you another example of this?
Yeah.
Sure.
In January, I was at a conference, and one topic I want to make sure we get around to is this new software standard for health data interchange called FHIR, F-H-I-R. I was at a FHIR work group meeting, and I got a bad case of COVID. And so I dealt with that. I wasn't all that sick, but the test strip was like bright red off the charts. A couple of weeks later, I discovered there's a feature in the iPhone called Cardio Fitness, which also exists on Fitbits. And I looked it up, and to my immense surprise, this is a measure. I'm going to hold my phone up to the camera in a moment. To my immense surprise, this number had dropped from 29 for me, which is above average, to 19 during the week when I had COVID, and it has not gotten better. So let's see, can you, so you see where it dropped there?
Wow.
And what this is, this is serious stuff here, okay? This is a measure of the body's ability to get oxygen out of the blood on exercise. And if you are not good at that, you know what happens if you get hospitalized for something? You go on a ventilator. Now, there's a couple of things here. There's a couple of things. This is, for anyone who's more medically knowledgeable, this is a proxy measure, an approximation for the fitness thing called VO2 max, right? And the volume of oxygen maximum you can get out of your blood. First of all, when I showed this to my doctor and said, I've got a problem in my blood vessels, because COVID is now understood that it's not a lung problem, it's a disease of the blood vessels. I said, I've got a problem here, and it's showing up in my ability to exercise. First of all, he'd never heard of the fact that this cardio fitness thing exists on smartphones, and he also had no idea what to do about it. So what did I do? So here we are. I know something that's going on in my body that my doctor doesn't know. The evolution of who knows what. And what do I do about it? So doctor didn't have advice, so I turned to Google. And I found out that what you do is what they call HITS, high intensity interval training. So when I'm out for my daily walk now, I've got an interval timer on my phone where every 3 minutes I start running for a minute. And it's working. The numbers are slowly increasing. The point here, again, is we are no longer in the era where only doctors know important stuff. I'll give you one more example, which is, like many people my age, a few years ago, I had cataract surgery. One eye went great. The other one had an accident. And the old pulverized lens fell apart and floated down to the back of my eyeball. Yes, I know. And what they have to, you know what they have to do when that happened?
Vacuum cleaner.
They have to empty your
eyeball. They vacuum out your eyeball.
Yeah.
Yes. It's called a vitrectomy. But anyway, my other things went wrong. And a few months later, I discovered that I'd gotten glaucoma in that eyeball. And I had already lost 30% of the optic nerve in my left eye.
Oh, no.
Now, glaucoma, well, the visual system is amazing. I have no measurable or observable loss of vision right now. You know, my 20/20, 20/40 stuff is the same as before. But here's the thing. Glaucoma is only managed. The only way they have to track and manage it is by measuring the pressure in your eye. Now, most of us have gone in and, you know, they put you up to the machine and they go poof with a puff of air.
Mm-hmm.
That is as ineffective as, of course, you only get that done, what, once a month, once every couple of months? That's as ineffective as a person with diabetes getting their blood sugar checked once a month. Now, so here I am, all of a sudden, I've lost 30% of one eye. What's the first thing I do after looking for a better doctor? I go looking for an e-patient community. And it took me 6 months, but I found one phenomenal group of people. It's called fiteyes.com. Completely free, highly patient-driven, and so on. And from them, I learned that there is a home eye pressure machine that you can get. And all you do, it's got a little plastic probe, and believe it or not, you can't feel it, but you hold it up to your eye and squeeze the button, and it goes flick, 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 and bounces off your eyeball. All right, so I measure my pressure, and indeed it bounces around like crazy. But this is really important to me because if I have more high pressure, see, turns out there are 36 different kinds of glaucoma. I never knew that, learned that from the patient group. Some of them don't involve increased eye pressure. They're what's called normal tension glaucoma, but it's still measured that way. Anyway, the normal range is 10 to 21, and I found that my pressure commonly bounced up to 25 or 30, and especially before I had corrective surgery this February, it was really high, and then they turned out part of the surgical accident that happened, they put the new lens in crooked.
Oh, yikes.
Which explains why I couldn't get any glasses that would work. Anyway, the point is, so having more information let me understand and manage my condition better than when doctors would tell me, just shut up and do what you're told.
Yeah, and I want to go back to the heart thing just one more time, just to show you this. If you can see that, I'm not sure how clear that is, but this is what happens when you're having an AFib attack. This is this shows you my heart rate. At the time I was having the attack, went up to like 144 to 158, and it was persistently like that, and it stayed like that quite a bit until the cardioversion. And I knew exactly what was going on, and I had data at my fingertips about what was going on. And when I walked into the hospital, I could tell them very clearly what was going on, and I could show them my heart rate and all of that. And that, you know, having a patient who has that data and understands what it is and how to use it is a huge difference from the way things used to be. And it really makes a difference.
Knowledge is power, no kidding.
So, John, what app was that you were showing?
Oh, this is an app called, let's see if I can, it's called HeartWatch.
HeartWatch, okay.
Yeah, HeartWatch. It's just an iPhone app that you can get. And there's also an HRV tracker if you want to keep track of your HRV or heart rate variability, I guess it is. And the interesting thing about that is that the medication that I take for AFib suppresses my HRV.
That would be metoprolol? You take metoprolol?
I'm not taking metoprolol. I'm taking propafenone.
Okay. I'm taking metoprolol and flecainide.
Yeah, that's a similar thing. And normally people who take propafenone, which is similar to flecainide, would also take metoprolol. But I was, for whatever reason, I've been able to do without it. And I actually have a pretty good case in that as long as I'm taking my medication, I remain in sinus rhythm consistently. But an interesting thing, I went in and talked. I had my regular annual appointment, and I was talking to, not to the doctor, the electrophysiologist himself, but to his assistant. And I said that I thought that my heart rate had been so stable for so long that maybe we could lower the dose of the propafenone. And she said, well, why don't you just try doing without? Just don't take it, you know? So I said, oh, well, really? You know, I can just stop like that? And she said, yeah, stop. We'll see what happens. And what happened was that 10 days later, I was in the ER with that AFib attack that I was showing you. So I'm okay when I'm taking the medicine. And a cardiologist I've seen since then said, you know, we talked about the possibility of an ablation and those kinds of things. And he said, well, you know, if you're okay when you take the medicine, just take the medicine.
Well, so here's an interesting thing. So my doctor in Santa Barbara, was no longer my doctor, turns out. But anyway, he said that, okay, to take the meds. Meds are working. And then the doctor in Bloomington said, well, We generally don't do ablation if you're over 75. Okay, well, I am now. Well, I should have told me that when I was under 75. We're still talking about it, apparently. But there's that kind of thing. One doctor tells you one thing, one doctor tells you another, you know. So you may want to talk ablation because it says that I don't know why not over 75. Maybe it doesn't work as often or has a lower efficacy rate. I'm not sure.
Well, so, my EP told me that ablation is less effective on people who've had prior cardioversions. Oh. He still wanted to do it. I mean, he was interested. He wanted to talk to me more about doing the ablation, but you know, it's sort of like,
I've never had that. That's
if I'm okay, what's the point? You know,
we're doing an e-patient thing right here, are we not, Dave?
We are.
We have a little community. John was actually witness to my very first AFib, as it turned out, and now we're learning about his. I'm going to pick up an app or two thanks to his example.
Well, one area of that needs help, I think, in the e-patient movement is helping people after the fact deal with the insurance carriers and the hospital billings.
Right.
Yeah, you could have a 12-part series on that. All I can say.
Well, there was when I was working with Consumer Reports, we actually had a campaign at Consumers Union called Surprise Medical Bills through the Safe Patient Project. And, you know, that I think there's legislation that passed finally that prevents this from happening or mitigates it somewhat. But people would be, they would be like in some kind of network of coverage or whatever, and then they would bring in somebody to administer a service, like an anesthesiologist maybe, who was out of network and would charge a huge bill. So they would get a huge unexpected bill that they, you know, there had never been a quote for it. There had never been any indication that they would be charged this amount, but it would be a large amount of money. And some people were, you know, getting devastating bills because of this. And that became an issue that eventually led to, I'm pretty sure legislation finally passed to prevent that from happening. I don't know how they prevent it, though. I don't know exactly what the rule is. But
I would like to get back to
fire,
the theme of the evolution of who knows what in healthcare.
You don't want us to just complain about healthcare
well,
systems.
Well, no, the medical, look, so it's kind of, this is almost a segue here because, so in 2007, as you said, I had my cancer year. And my advocacy and my accidental explosion onto the front page of the newspaper happened in 2009. In between, in 2008, I was just learning about healthcare. And by the end of that year, I had realized, and it was like this managerial epiphany, I had realized that the U.S. health system, and it's at least 50% bigger now than it was then in dollar volume, was so immense that any attempt to transform it was going to be met with enormous organizational and systemic resistance. And right at the end of 2008, I blogged on my old Blogger blog. I've come to the conclusion that our best path forward will be for us to get our data. You notice the shirt I'm wearing here says, mm-hmm. Own your health data, right? Get our data and start cobbling together systems on our own. And that led me, a few months later, there was an old thing called Google Health, where they were gonna be the Quicken or Mint or QuickBooks of medical data. You just bring it all together and they'll organize it for you. I clicked the button to do that with my hospital, and what came across was garbage, which totally shocked me. But this is a case for action for every one of our listeners to go through all the information we can get our hands on, because this one study said like 85% of medical records contain important mistakes, right? And anyway, I couldn't get a straight answer out of my hospital, so I eventually blogged it. And unbeknownst to me, this was at the beginning of the Obama, and this is going somewhere in a minute, so bear with me. This was right at the beginning of the Obama administration when the $40 billion of federal funding was being allocated to force hospitals to computerize, which is why every hospital today in the U.S. has a system like Epic, which offers patients MyChart, or Cerner, or various other systems. Epic is the 800-pound gorilla. And they, all the information is in the computer now. Now, two things people should realize. First of all, they're all required to have a patient portal like MyChart, but they are not yet required to share information with each other in any automated way. And that's why you'll find sometimes if you have hospitals that are in the same network, they share data. Sometimes if you have multiple Epic systems with multiple MyCharts, you'll be able to get at one hospital's data from your own patient portal, but they have to pay extra for that. Epic has such a dominant market position, this just makes me scream. They have a feature that every individual Epic can get called Care Everywhere that lets each hospital buy the extra software to make them talk. And then, but Everywhere doesn't include non-Epic hospitals. For that, you have to buy something else called Care Elsewhere. Isn't that, at least this is true.
And you buy it from Epic? You buy it from Epic?
No, when I say you, I mean other hospitals.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, okay.
You and I don't. But the remedy, and that this is positively huge. I've been a small part of this project for going on 5 years now. There is a new software standard called FHIR, F-H-I-R. It's completely open source, free to use, and it's based on HTTP and HTML. And it stands for Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources. Interoperability is the word a lot of people stumble on. It means that your blood pressure records, your hospitalization records, whatever, from one hospital will be readable by another hospital. Now, I say will be because this is very much like 1999 on the web, when Clutrain Manifesto was published, because the software has, the standards have been defined on how to do this. I was in Amsterdam last week with another FHIR developer conference. Federal law, starting last October 6th was the date, that said that every hospital that wants to get any money from the government has to have a FHIR, what they call a FHIR endpoint. It's basically a web address, a URL that anyone can get at. And if you give them your password, your app or another hospital has to be able to get all your data out at no cost. Now, this is very early days, as I say. The world that is beginning to open up now, just barely beginning, is the ability to get apps or develop other software services that will pull together what I tried to do 15 years ago, pull together your data. And so we'll start to see new services. So I guess watch out for that. You can, if you're the kind of person who wants to be an early adopter, you can ask about that. But it really is the beginning of the new world where you can get your hands on everything.
Well, didn't that really just say that like MyChart and MyHealthOne and apps like that will just start using that protocol?
to my knowledge, strictly speaking, my chart is only a window into one epic system. And that doesn't have to be done. That's a proprietary system. That doesn't have to be done using FHIR. FHIR is for system-to-system, app-to-app communication. Exactly like the way, I don't know, picture some old Honeywell computer, or you might have a program that lets you interact with your Honeywell computer, and another one lets you interact with your IBM computer, but that wouldn't make them share data, right? And that's where, when the web came along, within a couple of generations, every computer basically had HTTP built into it.
A dumb question, maybe. Is this one of the reasons why, to my persistent astonishment, doctors want to communicate, send data to each other by fax? An ancient analog technology.
They claim that.
It's still the case.
I know. And there's so much foolishness, you know, that they will complain that email is not a secure way to send you your information. And yet because it could leak, well, there are constant horror stories.
As a digital thing, it can leak. An analog can't leak because it's actually not digital.
We need pneumatic tubes.
Yeah, exactly.
Guess what? There are common horror stories of a doctor's fax machine dialing a wrong number and sending all your private information.
There's an analog hole for you. Wow.
Absolutely. But the other thing is, they don't have, in general, medical record systems don't have a way to absorb digital data from other computers. So all they can do is print it out and fax it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And then they just take that digital fax and put that in the computer, which means the information, you know, it doesn't just automatically go into your blood pressure records and so on. But that's exactly why FHIR is a big, big deal. And John, I don't think you've heard this. Of all the ironic things, my hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, was one of the pioneers of EMRs, electronic medical record systems. Well, I tried to connect doing my give me my damn data thing. So I wrote to tech support and said, where's the FHIR endpoint? What's the URL? And they said, it's coming. And then a couple of weeks after the first of the year, from one day to the next day, they switched and the legal people stepped in and said, we're not doing it.
That sounds typical for medical IT. I had the experience with the Epic's system. When I retired, I retired because we retired the system that I helped build for Kaiser's California billing system, and it was replaced by Epic. And so I retired, and I came out here. My wife has MS, and her MS doctor asked Kaiser for her records, her electronic records, because they famously, you know, boasting about their electronic medical records. They sent it, and it was totally unreadable. The doctor just gave up. Finally, he kept trying to say, we can't read your file format. And they just like, well, that's what it is. And that's kind of how the electronic medical record has failed to progress, is there's still too many proprietary things out there.
That is not legal. They have to deliver it in a usable format.
Yeah. Well, right. Now it's not legal, but then it was the Wild West. Like, well, if you don't have a system that can read it, you should buy an Epic system. You know, this a small doctor's medical group, they're not going to do that.
But that shows you progress there, right? It is not legal now to do that. And then it was. So we're progressing, not very fast, but we're progressing. We're getting really close to the hour. So do you have anything to say to kind of wrap this up? And maybe we could come back in a month or two and talk some more.
I'd be happy to. I want to touch on Doc's story from 2008, which is how you, John, introduced me to him. Doc, do you want to do a quick recap, or should I? Or
go ahead.
So, as I recall it, Doc had a scan, right, and needed to be able to read it on another doctor's computer, and it couldn't be read. And he, open source guru that he is, tried to use all of his various tools to open it, and it couldn't be opened. Today, there were real consequences, because
I got pancreatitis out of that, because they couldn't see well enough in the CAT scan. The first group of doctors that looked at it could not see in the whatever the scan was, it's the MRI CAT scan, whether or not a cyst on my pancreas is communicating with the duct. And the second ones that looked at it said, no, it's not. But in the meantime, I was given an ERCP. I was actually laying on the gurney where they're ready to sedate me. They already started sedating me. And they hand me a clipboard saying, sign this. And what does it say? It says you have a 1 in 20 chance of getting pancreatitis. And I said, okay, what the hell, you know? And I got pancreatitis and tied me up for 2 weeks. I lost a lot of money in speaking fees because I was going to speak in Europe during that time, a vacation. And when it's over, your chances of getting pancreatic cancer are raised if you've had pancreatitis. It was a real, and by the way, the cyst ended up being completely benign, has been since.
Yeah, whenever they you sign those things, be sure you read them.
Yeah, well, I read them and I did a stupid thing, but I was already sedated. I mean, come on.
It's completely unethical. Where this ties into the idea of interoperable data is two things. First of all, today, all radiology images are in a standard image format called DICOM. And so the image would be readable elsewhere if you can get it transferred. Now, radiology is the most forward-thinking specialty I know of, being in favor of interoperability. So that has improved. Having said that, Epic systems, images live in different systems. They don't live in the Epic or Cerner or something like that. But the work is just beginning now in FHIR to arrange to get data moved around where it needs to be. So things are improving. And again, I come back to this whole idea of the evolution of who knows what. 200 years ago, doctors would do what they could for doctoring, but they didn't have science yet. You know, it's only 200 years, not 200 years, less than 200 years, since we figured out that doctors washing hands would reduce infections, right? Then throughout the 20th century, doctors did have some science and we, the patients, didn't. But that era is over. We are now in the world where each of us can know useful stuff that doctors know, and sometimes we can even know things the doctors don't.
We've reached the end of our hour. It sounds pretty obvious that we need to follow up in a few weeks, so I'll get back with you guys. But thanks so much for joining us. What a talk.
Well, and I would love to dig deeper into Doc's reflections on this, because, like, you saw all this stuff way before most people, and I'm really curious.
The briefest possible reflection is we have the internet now. All this stuff should be possible. I mean, that's basically all Clutrain said.
Yeah.
You know, there's no need to persist industrial conventions that are counterproductive. So we can do it.
Very good. Wonderful.
Right on.
Great.
Okay. Well, so thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Guys, too.
Okay. We'll see you next time.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye, y'all.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.